Welcome to Kimapa. Jared and Robbie are here for another week of cricket. Well, I say another week. We missed last week because we were both too busy. Robbie was jet setting around.
It's also holidays. We can take a weekend. And I was busy. I was busy flying and covering cricket. And I did, what, 7 flights in 12 days?
There was a very good WhatsApp message where you were trying to do your best tired voice. So you could call out of the. This is a lesson to all younger people who ever have to call in sick to work. Never put on the tired or the sick voice. Just say, I can't do the job. But Robbie went, the flight got in at 4 a.m.
I was so dead, man. Oh, my gosh. Episode 40. We're going places, Kimbo.
Is that, you don't raise your bat for episode 40, though, do you?
No, we don't. Not yet. why is Rakshit getting excited about episode 40? We've got 360 more to go.
So we missed a couple of things. So we'll cover a few different topics today. But let's start with the Ashes because that's the fun one.
What did you think? Enlighten us, Jared Kimbo.
So I went on TalkSport one day, and it was a show I haven't been on TalkSport before, and I just went, they're dumb. England are dumb, right? And so I tried to explain it, and this was a very football-y show, right? So I tried to explain it in the most football way possible of, like, if you start scoring goals from, like, 30 metres out, right? Let's say you had all the best players in the world, Roberto Carlos and all the other guys like Roberto. He's the only one I know, right? But they're all scoring goals from 30 meters out, right? And you've seen this, I've seen this in basketball happen a few times before. If you stop trying to score in the box, right? The opposition, all the opposition teams are just going to start like defending you as if you're going to start scoring from 35 meters every time, right? And so the biggest issue that when you look at what has happened here is the fact that they came up with a theory that worked and never went with anything else. But also, I don't think they have improved as a cricket team or individually skills over all this time. I'm not sure that they're fitter now than when Bazball took over. I'm not sure that they're smarter or more talented or rounded cricketers than they were when they first took over. And you look at their fielding, Robbie, and that's the best one. And I remember when they first came in, they were sort of saying, off the record, I don't think they ever said this publicly, but off the record, they were sort of saying, we can all catch, right? We don't need to spend all of our time doing fielding drills. It's better for the players to relax and to go play some golf and chill out and everything. Yeah,
that's huge. Golf, right?
Yeah, always golf.
A big thing, right?
Yeah. And like, they are just a worse fielding side than they need to be. You can't convince me that they are a world-class fielding side consistently. They have players who can catch, don't get me wrong, right? They can pull off incredible catches, but they also drop sitters more than a team of their quality ever needs to. And that's what they look like. They look like a team that is set up for partying and relaxing rather than playing. And I think, you know, you and I would probably both agree that there is an element of you want your players to feel confident and you want your players to feel happy and comfortable, right? They're playing for their national side. And it's a big problem with, you know, Indian and Pakistan teams sometimes is everyone in those teams are so worried because of the press and you know, maybe getting dropped and losing their careers forever. And England set up the opposite of that. But they didn't set it up in a smart way. They set it up in the way that someone like Brendan McCullum, who's like a world-class athlete who, let's be honest, partied all the way through his career, that doesn't work for every single person, right? And to me, they set up a one-size-fits-all coaching / team model. And eventually it came crushing down when they played good teams, or in this case, when they played a more experienced team who used certain elements of Bazball against them, right? Like, that's the funny thing about this is Australia had been scoring slowly, but Australia stepped it up at certain times when they realized that England needed a bit of a kick in the behind. And so, I don't know, it just felt like to me,
was
dumb. Yeah, no, I do. I feel like they were dumb. I feel like they were lazy. I feel like they were one-dimensional. And I think ultimately, they came up with some great ideas, but then they believed their own ideas too much. And because of that, they didn't grow as a cricket team.
Yeah, fair. I think that's a fair point. I think, did you listen to Baz speaking post-match? After the second test match, was it? Or the first test match, was it?
The second one. You're talking about where they were planning on going to Noosa for holiday.
Yeah, and then even the time when you said, I think we're over-prepared and, you know.
Yep, that was that one, I think, wasn't it?
Well-rested enough or something like that, right? What do you think of that?
Look, did you hear what he said after the third test match when he was asked about his future as coach?
Oh, what did he say?
So after the test match, he basically said that he enjoys being the coach and that it's lots of fun and he loves traveling around the world with the team, but it's up to other people to decide whether he wants to stay on, right? And it's just like, again, it's I understand that they don't talk to the press and they don't talk to the fans, right? Mm. That this is something else, but it's like, do you want the job or is it you're not worried anymore about the job? Like, it's just, wait, let me just try and see. I'm trying to get the exact words here. It's a pretty good gig. It's good fun. You travel the world with the lads and try to play some exciting cricket and try to achieve some things. Is that what you want from your coach who's just lost 3-0? Because I think you and I would both agree on a certain point here, which is we don't want the players all being zombies every time they lose a game, right? We don't want the players getting too emotional or whatever or everything else. But we also, I remember, it'd be really interesting to get your view on this. So we covered the MS Dhoni series when they lost in England, then they lost in Australia back-to-back, right? Test series. Mm. And I covered every single press conference. And by the end of it, we were so upset with MS Dhoni as you know, as neutral cricket people, just because it was me and Sam Collins, and we'd covered every single test series, and he hadn't changed his vernacular at all. He hadn't changed his facial expressions. He was just like, yeah, you know, we're not playing good enough cricket, and it'd be great if we had an all-rounder and whatever. And I remember Sam, who was English, right? And by the end of that series, Sam did this question where he was just like, where's the passion? Where's the anger? Where's your reaction? And MS is laughing at him, right? Going, mate, what are you talking about? But MS didn't realize that Sam had been to every single press conference. And there is an element at a certain point where the pragmatism of MS Dhoni probably was holding them back a little bit, right? What they needed was someone to eventually go in and go, this is not good enough, guys, right?
Oh, I can assure you, bud, that if something was not good enough, he would make it known.
Yeah, but... No. But that wasn't coming out publicly, is what we're saying, right? Publicly, it was still the old MS, and I've been to about 40 MS press conferences in my life. Like, he's very much the same all the time, right? And and McCullum is the same on the up. It's a very different method, right? McCullum is the same. We know, like, I, you know, without reporting on it, I'm pretty sure this happened, that England had some pretty brutal meetings in Noosa during their holiday, right? And we could see from the way that Zach Crawley changed the way he played a little bit. You could see the way from someone like Ollie Pope probably looking like he's shot. He was probably told, last chance, mate, this is it, right? You know, and I think a few of the other players were told these things. But publicly, and this is what we were saying to MS on that day, which is at a certain point, you do actually have to show to the public that something has changed and that you understand what has happened. And you listen to Brendan McCullum's comments there, Robbie, and it doesn't feel like he's reading the room of where English cricket is at the moment. Now, you don't want him to be like an English cricket fan, because if he was an English cricket fan, they would go back to how cricket was in the 90s, right? But at the same time, he has to understand that this is a big thing and that he has failed. And I'm not sure it came across. It came across in Ben Stokes' press conference, to be fair. I think Ben Stokes was much more, they outplayed us in batting and bowling and fielding, right? And when it comes down to it, you know, but it didn't quite come across in McCullum's. And I think, again, they're just not reading the situation. And I think it's hard for English fans, because English fans are not really, we weren't ready for any of this, right? They weren't ready for the success of baseball, and they weren't ready for the failure of baseball, right? And so now they come into this position where they're like, well, what happens here? I think you have to understand your fan culture a little bit when you are in charge of a team, especially when you're McCullum and you've been in charge for so long.
That's true. I think he's generally by nature a very happy-go-lucky guy, and you know, likes to have his fun and trains quite a bit and keeps himself really fit. But I think, there are clear limitations in that Australia setup and England setup, and that number three is an issue, man. Ollie Pope not being in form is dire.
Yeah, it's incredible when you go through the team. So I put a video up yesterday, mate, where so we came in and basically both top threes had question marks, right? But the England top three is still exactly the same as what it was at the start of the series. And the Australian top three, like at one stage, Cameron Green was a chance of batting at number three, right? Usman Khawaja was going to be opening with Jake Weatherald. And instead, it's Travis Head. So Australia's top three has changed. And yet, Manus Labuschagne found enough form to get a couple of good knocks. Travis Head played incredibly in this series. And then, of course, Jake Weatherald overall hasn't made a lot of runs, but he made a couple of really important innings for Australia.
I think he's been quite impactful.
Yeah, impactful without making the big bags of runs, right? Like, his couple of partnerships have really mattered. And then you look at England's top three, Ben Duckett, who came in as the only player we all trusted, no runs at all, right? Ollie Pope looks completely emotionally shot. Like, both of the innings he played in Adelaide, he looked like someone who just wasn't thinking straight when he was batting. And Zach Crawley actually made 250s and another 40, right? But he's the impact player. And when he's made his runs, he's had no impact, right? Like, he just hasn't had the kind of impact that you want if you're going to pick someone like Zach Crawley. So their top three's failed. But then 4, 5, 6, and 7 is much stronger on paper than Australia's, right? Much stronger, right? And in form as well. Stokes has managed to stay in without making any runs. Root made his 100, but has been good without being brilliant. But Brook and Smith, right? No impact again. Right? Just no impact. And so somehow Alex Carey is the difference between these two sides, right?
I swear, dude. That was a top-notch innings, though.
Oh, I mean, he's been good for ages, but the difference is also now his ability to actually go beyond 60 odds, right? Because that's the big Alex Carey thing before, isn't it? And to be able to go beyond that is really... So you look at their strengths, Robbie, England, and they've come in and their strengths haven't worked. Brook, Duckett, and Smith have not worked in this series at all so far. And we had question marks over the bowl. Oh, I want to ask you about, try and explain to fans the difference between facing a frontline spinner for 25 overs and facing a sixth bowler spinner in Will Jacks for 20 overs.
There's a heaven and earth difference, to be very honest. I think when you're playing a world-class spinner, you're already under pressure. You're already anticipating what he could bowl to you. And you're trying to look at, if you're an aggressive batter, then you're always looking at, okay, what are my opportunities against this guy? What are the shots that I can play, can't play? Put the pressure back on him. When it comes to frontline spinners, I mean, you're always trying to protect yourself first before feeling confident enough to take the attack to him. Whilst at the same, when you're playing a non-frontline spinner, then you're not worried about survival. You're thinking more about how many runs can I get off this guy in 20 overs? Every spell, how many runs? And then a lot of batters are very, very clever about this. What they do is when they're actually facing lesser spinners, they look to score a boundary every second over, right? So, and then rotate the strike the rest of the time so that they can continue to milk him through the course of the innings. I think that holds good even in, say, one-day cricket. and it's obviously much harder. I remember I played a side game versus Australia when they were visiting. And Lyon, I was like, I really want to experience what it is to play against Lyon. Very seldom have I seen someone be able to get those kind of revs into the ball. I think he obviously gets a lot of revs into the ball. And then when those revs come through, they make that sound. There's a particular sound. And then I was like, wow, this guy is really, really good. And he's bowling regular off spinners because he's coming on top of the ball and giving it so much revs. On a wicket that didn't have too much bounce, just like bouncing quite high. So it becomes that much more challenging. Your mindset shifts completely. One is survival. One is like, okay, I'm going to score as many runs as possible. Milk this guy. So score a boundary every 6-7 balls, then just keep rotating the strike. Just average like 8 runs and over.
I'm laughing. My dad always used to say this to me. He'd be like, when the bad bowlers are, just score, 6, 7, 8 runs and over, so they don't take them off. And I'd be like, yeah, but I could score 20 runs off this over, which is, so you can tell I never quite had the right mindset of the way it went. But they were showing, I mean, one of the things that I think people don't understand, and this is, I'm not having a go at Will Jacks here, but Nathan Lyon is one of the most accurate bowlers in the world. Like he might be in of international quality spinners. The ability to put that many revs on the ball and land it exactly where you want consistently is phenomenal. But you looked at Will Jax's landing map and he went from basic, it looked like a fast bowler's landing map, right? He was back of a leg all the way through to Yorkers, right? Like it was all over the show. His line, Will Jax's line is pretty accurate, but his length is not accurate at all. And so there were times when the Australians were coming down the wicket to attack him and everything. And I was like, what are you doing? Just wait for the next short ball. Wait for the full toss. Wait for the half volley. And it's such a different mindset. I'm watching it. And, you know, that was, he ends up being a major bowler in their game, Robbie. And you're like, they've been planning for this series forever. Right, they've been thinking about it.
But can you blame them though? Like, how many? Like, I think one of the things that I've always kind of given, say, the benefit of doubt, say, other countries, whether it's England, Australia, South Africa is slightly better for sure. But just England and Australia, right? As in, there are only that many people in that country, right? There's only that many representatives you can actually have, and you need to pick a side and pick players that fit into any roles that you deem fit as a coach and a captain, and see if you can bring these guys in or not. So I think even the likes of the opener of the England side, we were just talking about him.
Crawley.
Jack Crawley. So even with him, even Jack Crawley, you could see that if he played in India, like I wouldn't have lasted the season, man.
Cricket boards actually make watching their games almost impossible. I spend almost as much time trying to find where I can view it as I do actually following the action. That is why I use NordVPN. They let me find all the cricket I want to watch while protecting me from the nasty side of the internet. Nord will free your cricket matches. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/goodareas to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan plus 4 additional months on top. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Watch every match with NordVPN. No. But, I mean, that doesn't explain why Will Jax is bowling 20 overs on day one of a test match. They have Will Jax. No one thinks Will Jax is the best spinner in England, right?
Like, they don't. But also, they want to. I'm sure their justification for it would have been, we also need a bowler who can bat a little bit.
What series did you... You're about to fly out and cover a series. Where is that series?
SA20.
Who was one of the best bowlers in the SA20 last year who might be English?
Sam Curran? No.
Spinner?
Spinner from England.
Liam?
Livingston.
Dawson.
Okay, huh?
Do you know what I mean? Like, this is... He's not quite as good a fielder as Will Jax, but he can field. He can bat. You know, you're talking about a guy with multiple, I don't know how many first class hundreds he would make, but he's a proper, you know, for a lot of his career, he's probably more of a batter than a bowler. He's a much better bowler. We saw him play against India. You know, we know his limitations, but he is a bowler who can put the ball on the right spot every time, right? He's not quite world-class frontline bowler. He's probably like a 4.5 bowler. Right? But Jax is like a 5.5, right? Like he's a full position down on him. Jax takes less than a wicket a game, I think, in first class cricket. Like we're not talking about anything. Now, I understand what they will say next is they will say, oh, but he's going to be bowling to a bunch of left-handers, so we can't take a left arm finger spinner, which is like, okay, so you've not
this
taken...
belief, no, that like a horse for courses matchups, it's like... It can be quite annoying to keep listening to it, you know?
Well, it's fine. But, okay, so who is going to be better against the left-handers? Will Jax, who has, I think, 50 first-class wickets in his life, right?
Yeah.
And is very much a part-time bowler in first-class cricket. Or Liam Dawson, who has 373 wickets in his career, right? In 214 games. So he's taking about 2 wickets a game. So basically a little bit more than double and as I said, a lot of his is probably more later on as he's become a specialist. He's also got, Liam Dawson, 1,000 first-class runs with 18 first-class hundreds, right?
Like 18.
Sorry, did I say 1,000? I meant 10,000 first-class runs. 10,000 first-class runs with 18 hundreds, right? Like this is a player, right? Mm. And an experienced player and everything else. So when you say, oh, they don't have that many players to pick from, Liam Dawson's not here. Well, there, wherever they are, right? Like... And so they came in with a theory, and their theory was, Robbie, that they needed a tall off spinner because they were going up against the left-handers.
And there are a whole lot of theories in baseball.
And the theory has been, like, did you say the way Head was playing against him? Like, I mean, it was ridiculous. I didn't look at the final numbers, but Head, I think Head scored much more than a run of ball against Will Jacks in this, right? And yeah. Will Jacks can still bowl the odd, very good delivery. Like, he's one of those, he's kind of that sort of what, more like a Moeen Ali part-timer than a Glenn Maxwell part-timer, right? Mm, like, he's one of those guys that when he bowls a good delivery, you do have to watch it. But it's so few and far between. And so, you know, let's get back to the Zach Crawley one, because I think that's really interesting. So Zach Crawley, you're right. They didn't have a lot of batting talent at that stage, and so they backed Zach Crawley. Except for the fact, Robbie, that in the last 2 years, a lot of those guys have started to make runs in the top order of England. They did have backups now. So when it first started in baseball, I have no problem with them backing Zach Crawley and going, this is our guy. But they were backing him because they thought he was going to make runs in Australia. And then he gets to Australia, and and every shot he plays is a drive on the up. You've played in Australia. Can you tell people why technically driving on the up is really tough in Australia?
Because there's so much bounce. And it's as simple as that. And can depending on who's bowling, it can be skiddy, come on nicely. But it will come on nicely, and there's bounce there. So you want to come inside the line of the ball more than anything else. Because that way you're able to you know, execute well, and the efficiency of execution, you know, works well. So it's strange, but I think even Zach Crawley and Will Jacks, I think obviously Will Jacks for a completely other reason, but Zach Crawley I think is on thin ice right now.
So let's imagine we were in charge. Mm-hmm. What do you keep and what do you leave? I mean, there isn't another obvious captain in this squad, right? So it's other than Root, and Root's not going to take the job back. So no, I assume not. You have to convince Stokes to stick around at least for a year while you work out what the hell you're doing in the future, right? I think McCullum is probably going to go. But don't forget, they just made McCullum their white ball captain because of all of his success in red ball cricket.
Wow.
White ball coach, sorry. And Rob Key's the other interesting one, right? Rob Key's the third person in all of this. Mm-hmm. I'm not a person who says these people must be fired and everything else. I don't care whether they fire them or keep them. But if these people aren't showing growth and aren't showing that they're going to change their ways a little bit, right? So you know, they got rid of
also the thing with baseball, right? I think it's like, it's just one, like you said earlier, it's one size fits all. And because it's one size fits all, they've not even tried to have a backup plan or a way to kind of go if the bowling gets really good and they find a way to tie these guys down. I didn't see Australia doing anything special.
No.
So, whatever little I followed off the third test match, which is not very much to be very honest, but whatever little I watched for like 45 minutes or an hour was like just saw Australia bowling really disciplined lines and lengths, like just hit top of off, you know? And if the ball moves from there, so be it, but just try and hit top of off as often as possible. And when they did that, these guys had no idea what to do, man. And that's pretty scary. Like to think that you're playing the Ashes, which is one of the biggest rivalries in world cricket, and you've gone there with just one plan, and then you haven't executed the, say, plan B anywhere else, and suddenly in the middle of the Ashes, you're asking them, like, you're giving giving instructions saying, okay, let's, you know, play defensively, and suddenly moved away from baseball. So you're like, shit, how are you gonna make this work? It's not gonna work.
And you're talking about the batting there, but I can't think of a 45-minute period in this entire series where England have bowled at the top of off stump.
No, they haven't.
Like, I mean, that's got to be one of the most remarkable things that's ever happened in cricket. We just watched a series where a team is 3-0 down, and at no stage did they think to themselves, what if we bowled at the top of off stump just for a little while, just for shits and giggles, just to see what might happen. Let's try this thing that is the most famous thing in cricket. And they never did it, Robbie.
But Ben Stokes also isn't patient enough to try something for long enough, right? Like, and that poses another challenge, right? Because as a captain, if you're asking the bowlers to bowl different lengths and try different things, and every third or fifth over, if your plan changes, how, like, you're not even building consistency, right? You can be the best bowler in the world, but if you can't hit the areas that consistently and hit particular areas consistently, then how are you going to reap the rewards of it?
We were talking about this in the Indian series last year of how many times I pointed out that the bowler would be walking back to their mark and Ben Stokes would completely change the field and the bowler wouldn't even know. And we were like, we were saying at the time, like, they must trust him incredibly, because if I was a bowler and I would want to know where my field is before I bowl. And he doesn't seem to even tell them. I felt that this was the series when some of the bowlers were like, wait, what? Like, coming in, you could see after the delivery go, wait, why is the field like that? And I think the Jofra incident, I don't know if you saw that, when Jofra and Ben Stokes, I didn't have any issue with that, because that, you and I know that's a conversation that happens all the time,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But there was an element of like, Jofra's like, you want me to bowl really fast, back of a length, outside off stump, right? And you've got a number nine who slashes all the time. Can I not get a little bit of coverage? And it's very fair for Ben Stokes to be like, that was too wide and you deserve to be hit for four. Like, both of those conversations are completely fine. But I did feel that was what was happening here. There was a conversation with the bowlers where the bowlers are like, wait a minute, what are we bowling to here? The field is, where's our, I had a mid-off a minute ago. Where's mid-off gone, right? Like, there did feel to be an element of that a little bit. So I can understand it, but I find it remarkable. If you look at, I think you probably watched this session by what you were saying before. Australia on day two and day three, right? When they came out and all they did, they went, it's a flat pitch. Let's just bowl at the top of off stump, right? Let's mix around our bowlers a little bit. Let's set, you know, not massively attacking fields, but nothing that they could score quickly from as well.
Mm.
And bowl at the top of off stump. And for about a session and a half, Australia bowled beautifully. And they basically won the Ashes in that session, right? That was the session and a half that they won the Ashes.
Mm.
And I remember when they came out later, England, I was like, well, they're obviously going to follow that map. This is it. They've learned now. They're not idiots. They're batting more defensively. So they've learned. And then they just didn't, right? And so it comes back to that conversation me and Harmy kept having. Can they not bowl at the top of off stump? Do they not have that skill set? Or is this just a plan that they have decided is eventually going to work for them? It's so fascinating to have a look at this. And a lot of people have said Atkinson was dropped, right? And he was the wrong guy to drop. They should have dropped Cass or whatever. And I was like, but Atkinson is supposed to be their accurate bowler. Go back and have a look at his spells. He has not been, I reckon he's had two good accurate spells in the first two test matches. I actually think he was a little bit injured as well, but that's a different thing. But if he's the guy who's supposed to be bowling at the top of off stump and he's not doing it, like, where are you? Like, it's such a shit show when you think of it. I don't know, you might feel differently. I actually don't think on pure talent there is that much between these two teams. This is not, if you look at the lineups, this is not a 3-0 team to Australia.
No, for sure. Not 100%, man. That's not a 3-0 team inside. But
so you have to work hard to get to this position, right? What's it like? You must have played for a team that's done this once before. What's it like when you feel like you don't know how to fix the thing that's going wrong? I remember when I was working with Scotland, and we were supposed to win their qualifiers and make it to the World Cup easily, right? And we lost our first game to Singapore and we just couldn't get our momentum. And I remember Ian Bishop like calling me over on the ground one day and going, Jared, what's happening? And he could see, and I didn't know what to say. And he looked at my face and he goes, if you knew what was happening, you would have fixed it. Don't worry about it. And he pushed me on my way because he could see my face. That I didn't know what to, I couldn't even give him an answer. When am I ever stuck for words, Robbie? But I couldn't work out what was going on with the team. I couldn't work out why we were playing so poorly, right? And eventually it came good and we stormed home at the end of the season and it was fine. But you have played with that where sometimes you're like, everyone's like, what's going wrong? And you're just like, we're not winning?
Yeah, and actually it's okay if you don't win in test matches, but like you don't want to lose so badly. Like, especially with the kind of team that they have, the personnel that they have, you want to, like, even if you're going down, you want to go down with some pride, right? You want to say you fought really hard. I'm not saying they're not fighting, but I just don't think there's any clear plan whatsoever. Like, he's just being driven by instinct, I think, completely, right? If you look at Ben Stokes on the field, it feels like he's just being purely instinctive with his calls at the field. So it just makes it that much more challenging for I think the bowlers, you know. But maybe, I don't know, if the bowlers can get a little bit more autonomy whilst they're bowling, then maybe they can actually just hit top of off stump all the time.
It is interesting, isn't it?
Because for me, when you look at, sorry buddy, when you look at Jofra bowling, right, you know, he's bowling gas, right? And sometimes with that level of speed, you actually want to just be as accurate as possible. Because if you're just in the ballpark of being accurate there, he'll get wickets, right? But also England don't think that they need a field. So that poses another problem.
I mean, to be fair to Jofra, I mean, he was obviously their best bowler in this series by a distance. And he bowled some really, really good spells. But it's hard when the guy at the other end is going for 15 runs, right? Like,
you have to bowl in partnerships.
Yeah, there was a couple of times when Jofra bowled really well, but Cass couldn't get it together, right? Or Atkinson couldn't get it together. Or, you know, Stokes came on first change or whatever. Like, they just really struggled to consistently put the ball in the right area over a long period of time. It's fascinating. It'd be fascinating to see what happens now.
I tell you what's even more fascinating. Hmm. I said, hey, what do you think about the Ashes? And here we are 31 minutes later. I've been smiling all along because I knew all I needed to do was just ask you one question.
I don't even know if I've started the conversation on the Ashes yet. I feel like there's a lot more out there.
Oh, sure, there's a lot more. Of course, there's a lot more.
Robbie, what do you think of the Indian World Cup squad?
Well, I was shocked. Like, I just came back home and I thought, okay, and I was just spending time with the kids and I was like tired because I obviously traveled late at night. And then came back home and then I was like, okay, let me just take a nap. Took a nap and I woke up and saw my phone. I was like, what? Like, what? Like, I was like really happy. I think they picked a solid side. I think they picked a gun side. But I think the way they've gone about it, and for me, it's not like it's not dropping people, right? It's about how you go about making these decisions, right? With Ishan Kishan, with the way he's performed, you can say he deserved to be there. Rinku should have been there in the first place, right? You should have just carried a 16th player, dude, in your bilateral. You didn't need only 15. It's a bilateral. You carry 16, 17. Who the heck cares, right? And then you just reduce the team from that, right? And so it actually supports your narrative if you actually carry 16, 17, whatever, in a home bilateral series. And then if you have a World Cup squad coming up, then you can actually pick out who you want to pick out. But for me, it was the Shubman thing. Like, I'm not saying he deserved to be there. Like, I think given his current form, as in it, and the fact that he's not looking like he's, you know, in good nick. And you can see his eyes. Like, when you look at him, it feels like there's a lot of confusion, even when he's batting, right? And he's getting some good deliveries. Lungi bowled really well through the series and troubled Shubman when he played in those first three games. And obviously, you know, him not doing well or having a middling Australian series and then, you know, the Asia Cup even, I thought it was slightly middling as well, and not much to take home about. But just the way he came in, there should have been like at least you shouldn't have brought him in the first place as a vice captain. Like, you bring him in, like, you already have a vice captain, right? Like, leave that as it is. Don't touch it, or don't announce a vice captain.
Oh. Don't get me started on Indians talking about vice captains when they don't need to. But I think you're right. I think this is the thing with Gill is they brought him in when they didn't need to. They brought him in the wrong way. And then now they've taken him out. My question to you is, do you pick World Cup squads on form, right? Because the Ishan Kishan one, to me, is fascinating. Because Ishan Kishan did not have a great IPL, right? I think people like you and I have been waiting for him to eventually...
He got 100 early. He got 150. Yeah, and then just like Ishan Kishan disappeared in the IPL,
right? Like, and so I know he's been incredible in the spat and he's got great form, but that's a much lower level to be picking him from at the moment. So he's been picked 100% on form, right? And Shubman Gill has been dropped 100% on form. But we know what Shubman Gill has managed to do for the last 3 years, and we know what Ishan Kishan's managed to do for the last 3 years. And so in a World Cup, usually what happens is that you default not to form, but to overall talent, right? And you go, okay, Shubman Gill's not in great form. We still back him to come. Maybe we won't have him in the 11, and maybe we won't make him vice captain anymore, but we'll keep him around and we'll see what actually happens here, right? But
so I actually don't agree with you about
the
that.
Other way. Hey?
I'll tell you, I actually don't agree with you about that. Simply because I think, I just forgot what you just told, what you just said, and I what I don't agree with you about.
you said you don't agree with me, and then you realized that obviously I'm always right, and there was no point.
No. What did you say? Say that again.
So what I was saying is, Ishan Kishan's been picked completely on form, and Shubman Gill.
Okay. So with Shubman, I'll tell you, with World Cup sides, right? You can carry up to one player who's not in great form. You can't carry more than that.
That's the problem. Yeah. I think he's been dropped because Sky's not making runs.
That's probably it, you know, because you're going to carry Sky, because if Sky comes off, you know, you want Sky to come, like, I can tell you, I don't think Sky is out of form. Like, people who haven't played cricket at a certain level will not understand when we're saying he's not out of form, he's out of runs.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, look at the difference between him and Ollie Pope. Ollie Pope looks like someone who is out of form.
Completely right? out of form. Shubman Gill looks out of form.
Yeah.
Shubman Gill looks out of form, right? I'm telling you, I've watched Sky bat in the nets. Boy, he was hitting shots in fog, like in Lucknow, under fog. He was hitting full-length balls over third man for six. Like what he did in the IPL, he was doing that off the front foot. To full length balls outside the off stump, over third man for six. So you can't do that if you're not in form. Mm. One thing I did notice about his batting, when he came into bat in the first T20I, his technique has changed. The way he sets himself up has changed. It felt weird. And then by the third game, he came back to his old technique or his old setup. And that's the thing about the lack of runs. When Tilak got his back-to-back hundreds in South Africa, I said, all well and good that Tilak's gotten runs, and that's amazing. But I said back then, I don't know how, it must be a year ago, I said back then that if Sky, God forbid Sky goes out of form, or goes out of runs, doesn't get too many runs, this is going to impact him. If Sky doesn't get runs in the World Cup, then post the World Cup, I don't think Sky will play in the T20 I side anymore.
No, I agree.
And I've seen, like, there have been teams where people have been carried. I remember the 2011 World Cup. If I'm not wrong, Rakshit, you can just do some research. If you can just tell me. I don't know if... Like, I remember that, like, Dhoni wasn't in the best of form, right? The only time he kind of... I think, if I'm not wrong, I don't think he got more than one or two 50s in the entire World Cup. And the finals was one of those. In the 2011 World Cup. He was not in very good form. Can you check that?
Where? India. Oh, Dhoni. What's his name, Dhoni?
MS Dhoni.
241 runs. Yeah, made the 150. Yeah. So he ended up with an average of 48, but that was with the 91 not out.
Not outs, yeah. And then there were not outs as well. So how many games?
He made two less runs than Collins Aboya.
How many? Wait.
You know who Collins Aboya is, though.
Yeah, but wait, man. You and your cricket.
Maybe Colin Aboya should be the hero of the 2011 World Cup. I'm just throwing it out there.
No, but I'm saying it's happened before where teams have carried important players who are not in good form because of what they can potentially do. They're match winners, right? So it's not like teams haven't done that. And teams will still do that, right? And I think... You can only carry one player like that. You can't carry more than that.
Yeah, I think let's be honest. I wouldn't have picked Shubman Gill. I wouldn't have made him vice captain. I wouldn't have brought him back.
Okay, you spoke back then. I didn't complete my point back then. My point was that what they've done with just the way this whole thing is transpired, right, will send a larger message across the board to the Indian cricket fraternity.
Yeah.
Right? That anything can happen to anyone in Indian cricket. Right? And that, for me, over time, breeds insecurity. Right? And that is an issue for Indian cricket. Because if you're operating from not being secure and you're operating from insecurity, then you're operating on survival mode at all points. And if you're operating on survival mode, there will come a period where you will be at the back end of a tournament under pressure and you will falter. And that's something I'm concerned about over a period of time.
Okay. So we both agree that the Zach Crawley method doesn't work, right? Of just picking someone when they're not making runs. But we also don't agree with the opposite of that, right? Where everyone always feels like their spot is underplaced. And that's what we're basically trying to say, right? And look, it's hard to get the middle ground. So I don't think he should have
been. It's not hard. It takes effort to get to the middle ground.
Right? Yeah, yeah. And also, I don't know if we talk about this enough, Robbie, but I find this quite interesting. We're in the first period ever of selectors being professional. Right. So it's only the last, 10 years? So Merv Hughes was an Australian selector in, I want to say, 2013-ish, right? And Merv Hughes didn't have a Foxtel subscription, Robbie. So he couldn't watch overseas tours unless he was on them on those booze cruises that he does, right? So he was selecting the Australian team, right? And unless Cricket Australia sent him into a game, he couldn't watch it, right? Unless he was literally...
Why didn't he have that subscription?
He was tight. He didn't have a lot of money. He was an amateur. He wasn't getting paid by Cricket Australia, right? And he was like, well, why would I pay for this? They're the ones who gave me this position, right? Don't get me wrong. He should have just paid for the subscription. He also said, Robbie, that you can't learn much from watching cricket on TV. I'm like, I think there's a few things you could learn. But anyway, shouldn't have been a selector. But the point being is those are the sorts of people who would be, and that's in Australia. And Australia was the first place, I think, in the world to have paid selectors, right? I think Merv Hughes might have been one of the reasons they went with paid selectors. if you think with players, right, we're now, by the time you came through, you were in the second or third generation of players who were professionally paid, right? Different parts of the world have been a little bit different. But essentially, from the early 90s, most players in international cricket at the top level, the top eight players anyway, were professionals. And then by the early 2000s, you had about 15 or 16 people who were professional. And then by the mid-2000s, even the first class cricket was becoming professional, right? So we've had quite a few generations. And if you go back, Sunil Gavaskar played like a professional, right? And, you know, if you go back, Don Bradman played like a professional. They were professionals, but they played like professionals. Selectors, up until very recently, were just an old guy who was lovely, who liked watching cricket, who would become the selector.
And honorary jobs, right? It's not a paid gig.
Did you have free time? Did you like wearing a blazer? Did you like being abused in the press? Like, I mean, I know it sounds weird, but you and I know that there was a lot of people who should never have selected international. The domestic ones are way worse. But in international level, there were people who should never have been involved in international selection committees, right? Who weren't taking it seriously, who weren't being paid to do it, who weren't doing the hours or anything else. So we are in the first generation of professional selectors. And I do think that is a bit of an issue when it comes to cricket, because we don't have this long history of doing it and the job still isn't done correctly. I mean, you could argue that we don't need selectors at all. And what we need to do is do what other sports do, which is have a director of cricket or a general manager type position. And then they have scouts who work for them, which is kind of what England we're getting towards with Rob Key, right? But that kind of setup is probably a lot more sensible than what we see at the moment. But the point being is, and I know this sounds weird, but selection is actually one of the least mature parts of cricket in the world. And I still think that we see a lot of mistakes because we don't have professionals who do it day in, day out and think about it correctly until the last couple of years. And there isn't a method or a mold with this. And it reminds me of what coaching was like in the 90s. Right? When Bob Simpson came along and everyone was like, oh, we all need international coaches. And you had like Bumble coaching, right? And, you know, Bumble is coming from umpiring, but everyone loves Bumble and he's obviously a very smart guy. So you give him the job. But Bumble didn't even know what international coaching was because there was no template for Bumble to look at. Right? So he came in with a first-class coaching mentality, which is very different to what you want at the international level. Right? And that's what I'm trying to say. So I understand why selection is still so bad in cricket. And I think a lot of it is to do with the fact that we don't train people up. They don't have the right methods behind them. They don't understand what they're supposed to be doing. And we're not quite there. So I can see why mistakes are made. And I think in this particular case with Gill, there was pressure to get him into the side so that he could take over as the captain when Sky was eventually phased out. So they could have the one captain involved in all three formats. And they've just made a bit of a mistake with that decision. Ross Taylor couldn't see at night or when the clouds were in. Eventually, he had to see an eye specialist who would fix his eyesight. In the 2 years before the change, he still averaged more than 50 in international cricket. The top level of batting talent can basically see in the dark. That is who we are talking about in our new book, The Art of Batting. Head over and order your copy today.
Yeah, they have. And they've corrected it, and rightly so.
Yeah.
My concern only comes from the point of view of, you know, the larger impact this has on the team, the larger impact it has on, like, you know, as imagine you exist in a team where you feel, and they've done this to the captain of two formats and who is the vice captain of a current team, right? It's just, you know, it's...
They're playing with fire, right?
Yeah, it is. In the long term, yeah, in the long term. Yep. In the short term, yes, it's the best decision in the short term. I'm not arguing there.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the implications of this decision on... It's like the potential collateral damage that will happen over time.
Yeah.
And it'll happen at... You know, it'll happen in... It could happen, for me, it could happen in intense matches, crucial games, big games at the back end of a major tournament. Because that's when things unravel, right? Because you're operating purely on survival. Because when you're operating on survival mode, you're not really looking at thriving, right? You're looking at how do I play the next game? What do I need to do to survive this whole system, to move forward, to progress my own career, right? And that's how you're operating. Now, versus you have the security and things have done with a semblance of balance. The effort has been put to communicate with the personnel. The effort has been done to not shake the apple cart when it's not required. Mm. Like in the first place, you didn't have to move Sanju away from where he was because that partnership was working. Why do you want to fix something that is not broken? But you've done that, right? And so you've already created instability there, right? You've already kind of messed with the energy a little bit of the group, right? Suddenly, you would imagine that what is the captain going to say to a performer like Sanju, who's actually been the first one amongst the guys in this team to score 100 of the youngsters who joined the team post the T20 World Cup in 2024. Mm-hmm. He was the first guy to score the back-to-back hundreds in South Africa. And then Tilak followed suit. And then Abhishek Sharma followed suit, right? And then he came to India and scored 100 against Bangladesh as well. And then when he and Abhishek bat together, my word, they look like they can get, like, they feel like Jayasurya and Kalu Vitarana. It's like anything can happen, dude. Like, 300 can happen today, you know, in a T20 game. It feels like that. That's the energy that they both bat with.
I wonder if there isn't an element, too, of, I know the vice captaincy was a big part of it and getting the, you know, the poster boy in and everything else. But I also think there's an element of, I wonder if they won't worry about in peak pressure situations of not having, if Sanju's going to be going and Abhishek's going to be going, if they just wanted that sort of more anchory person there who they know has made international. Yeah.
And see, I've been saying that, right? We've spoken about it and I still believe. And that's why in my World Cup squad before this whole thing happened, I was like, I want Shubman Gill to play the role that Virat Kohli played for India in the 2024 World Cup. A lot of people not agree with it, but you have to understand, like, when you're playing cricket that aggressively, you will, and if you're following the template that Sunrisers Hyderabad follow in the IPL, you will do well in patches. And you will do exceptionally well in patches and be super exciting in the moment. But that is not sustainable in big games. Is Tilak, can he play the anchor? Yes, he can play the anchor. And that should be the role that should be like handed down to him, right? But the beauty about Tilak is he can play both roles.
I think Sanju can as well. Like, I think we've seen Sanju.
You don't want
play.
Sanju to do that.
No. But I'm saying, I think in a bad situation, I think you have the ability.
Yeah,
for
he did that in the Asia Cup
as well.
He did that in the Asia Cup. He went there when he was batting with Tilak at number 5, he actually did that role in the finals.
Yeah. I don't mind the Sunrisers batting for India because the problem with Sunrisers...
Let me
explain why. Sunrisers have to beat you with the bat and they can't make runs consistently because of the way they bat. Agreed?
Agreed.
India don't have to beat you with the bat. They can beat you with the ball as well. So they can have a fail and still make 140 and then Bumrah and Kuldeep and Chakravarti help you.
But I'll tell you what. When one of the things that I'm concerned about, say the 2023 World Cup, right? India got what, two, how much did we get? 230, 240 in the finals? Or 220 or something like that?
I can't remember.
Yeah, I can't remember. But whatever it was.
Which one? Which game?
In the finals of the 50-over World Cup.
Right? Oh, 2023 one. Yeah, around 240, yeah. Wasn't it?
Yeah, around that. And so India knew that they had to get wickets. And India knew that Shami and Bumrah had to get wickets. And they knew that they had to get wickets and they tried too hard. And that's what happens in big games, right? In high-pressure games, in big games, when you need something and you start trying for it desperately, then you go over the edge, right? I'm not worried about the league stage for India. That's not my concern. They will get to the back end of the tournament. For me, it's that it's for me, it's what they do in the back end is what concerns me.
It's actually, it's fascinating now that because there is such a gulf between the top three and four teams quite often and everyone else, that it is a completely different form of cricket once you get to those major games. And I think it's one thing that fans are probably going to struggle to get their head around. That yeah, so I think you and I would both say that the IPL is a very high level of cricket.
It is. Right? It's just below, right? It's just maybe half a step below international cricket.
Well, so I would, this is what I was going to say is I think the IPL is a step above international cricket until you get to the semifinals of the World Cup. And then suddenly there is a huge gulf between the IPL and that other level, right? But up until that point, the IPL teams are so strong now that, like, you know, like for a lot of the more normal international teams, they're nowhere near the IPL level consistently, yeah, right? Yeah, but once yeah, you yeah. get to that semifinal, and this is what football has always been. Hilariously, right? Which you know is a very similar thing of like you know the Premier League and you know in Spain and Germany these really good leagues where you have really good teams and you see some people go why am I watching this when you know but then you get to the quarterfinals of the Football World Cup and suddenly you're like oh this is a different level this is out of it right and I think you're seeing that now and so that's where I understand the idea of your what you're trying to say of it's very hard to be. The Sunrisers at that level of cricket when the opposition bowling is, you know, Rabada and Ngidi and Jansen and whoever else, right? Like now things have changed, right? It's not one good bowler you have to overcome or two good bowlers. It's like five, right? And it's the same with the batting, right? You know, the depth and the strength and whatever. So I do think it's very, very, very fascinating. Do you want
to... I just read what Rakshit said on the private channel. I was laughing because... Did he actually say that?
That's fake news, isn't it? He no, said that's guy fake news, said maintaining lefty righty is overrated. They don't want to keep doing that. has a player ever said a more boring thing in their life, which is actually a complete attack on their coach?
Gosh, oh my word! It's
I have a piece, by the way, on lefty righties in Test match cricket. Because of Gambia that I'm going to bring out soon. It's really interesting.
Lefty righty is in test cricket.
Yeah. Okay.
Like, see.
I'm going to ask you a question. Just give me, let me cook for a second.
Objective answer, cook.
In all of cricket, right? And it doesn't matter what the format, what is the best partnership to have? Right hand, left hand, or left hand, left hand?
Right hand.
It's left hand, left hand. It's the highest average consistently. Right. And it's always been fascinating to me. If you think back, there's, you know, of like Hayden Langer. I remember in Australia, they were like, we can't have two left-handers together. Right. And not in those days, no one had the advanced stats or anything. Right. But consistently, left-hand together is the best partnership, I think, in all three formats of the game.
I thought by sheer volume of right-handers to left-handers, they'd have a better average.
Well, no. So right-hand is the lowest average. Right. And it's pretty consistent of that. But that's also because there's so many extra right handers, right? And it's hard for left handers to even get in the side. Volume of runs is huge because there's so many more right handers than anything else.
That's right. Yeah.
But it is quite fascinating when you look at that of like everyone wants left hand, right handed together. And it's like, actually, left handers together do better than anyone else. So it is, I mean, obviously, if you only had a team of left handers, the opposition would just pick three off spinners, right? And one Jofra Archer type guy, and you'd be in trouble. Like, there's a reason why Gambia wants the mix. And I certainly understand that. But I did think it was quite fascinating.
I'll tell you why he wants the mix. He wants the mix because when he was captain, it worked for him. right? It brought him success. You will always go back to things that brought you success. It's human nature.
It's McCullum, right? McCullum partied hard and he played hard and he always thought positively, which is great, right? But that worked for Gambier and his team, and that worked for McCullum and his team. If you're a great coach, you have to have the ability to be like,
Do what works for you. Like what is that NBA coach's name who coached
Bobby Knight,
the Bulls? No, it was who coached Bulls when
Phil Jackson.
Phil Jackson, right? Like he let Dennis Rodman go on a 3-day kind of complete bender, you know, and then it was Jordan who said, send a charter and bring him back now.
Mm.
Right? But he asked for that bender and he got that bender. Right? And that was insane. Right? That's insane level coaching and captaincy from say, a Jordan and Phil, because they catered to that.
Yeah.
You know, and that's amazing, right? But that is what you need at the elite level. You need to meet people where they are.
Exactly.
Like, because that's what I think coaching is. Coaching is, and doing it in a balanced manner. They didn't let him do it the whole season.
No.
But right before the big final, they're like, okay, go.
It wasn't just things like that. Like, Robin's a really good example. And so he was with Detroit, right? And with Detroit, it was quite regimented, but he loved the coach. He'd had this good thing. And then he went to San Antonio with them. And San Antonio's went on to be one of the best run organizations in the world, but they couldn't handle Rodman because they tried to bring him in line the whole time doesn't work. And then he goes to Chicago, but they did things in Chicago that it's not even mentioned in some of them, but things like they gave him access to the gym 24 hours. They said, we don't care when you lift. If you lift after at 4 a.m.,
go and party.
That doesn't matter to us. We just care that you keep lifting because we need you to be strong for when we get to the playoffs, right? And little things like that.
It's meeting people where they are, right?
Yeah.
Right? And that's... So I think one of the things about coaching that goes amiss today is coaching is not... coaching is a service-oriented job at the elite level. You're not directing people. You are basically a bridge to help them prepare to the best of their ability, to give them the best chance to be successful. That is all the job is. It's what Gary Kirsten did. Gary Kirsten. And I think that's why some of the best coaches in the world are not former captains, but just players, right? Players who've done well. Like, I think people who excel at coaching understand that it's a service-oriented job. My job is to provide the best service to each individual player in a way that fits them, that makes them feel like I'm best prepared for tomorrow for the match or for this tournament coming up, right? There are some non-negotiables as far as fitness is concerned, as far as, you know, punctuality is concerned, as far as, you know, discipline is concerned. But outside of that, whatever they need to do, can I provide it to them on the field and off the field for them to feel like, okay, I feel good about myself. And that gives me the best chance to do well in the tournament or to do well tomorrow. I think that goes amiss. Which is why, say, coaches like Langer and all that weren't appreciated, because it's too regimented for the elite level. You can't coach schoolboys.
But Langer's a perfect example of someone who couldn't reach out to every single person, right? Because, again, in his mind, this is the way that we play. This is the baggy green cricket and you have to do this.
Yeah.
And so, I've been on coach panels to find coaches before, right? And it's like the people who hire the coaches don't understand everything that you've just said. They don't understand that, like,
because cricket's not run by, cricket is run by administrators who haven't played cricket.
Yeah, but it's not just that they haven't played cricket. There are a lot of times as well, even the people who have played cricket don't think about what coaching is, right? Like if you spend an hour with Mickey Arthur, right, and you chat to Mickey Arthur about random things, you cannot walk away from that conversation and not think that that man is a coach. And he understands individual role definition and he's got in his head and everything else. Doesn't mean he's going to be a great coach or a terrible coach or whatever, but you understand that he thinks like a coach. And I have spent a lot of my career talking to coaches, right? And asking them about their stuff. And so I have a unique perspective that even you don't have, right? Because it's my job to go in and talk to, and I can tell straight away if someone is a Ravi Shastri, Brendan McCullum, Gautam Gambhir type of person, or if they're a Mickey Arthur type of person, right? It's very clear to me with the sort of answers I get. That doesn't mean that Ravi Shastri didn't have great success. It doesn't mean that McCullum and Gambhir haven't had success and won't have success again. But it's a very different type of person, and it's a very different type of coaching style, right? And I think in cricket, sometimes we don't think about the entire picture of these things. We look at what they were like as players. We look at what their reputation is like, right? And realistically, that's not how you should be picking coaches. You should be going, who's the person that comes with the vision that we're looking for, right? That we want to be able to, that we think that they could do. And then can they make every individual player better? Because I think there's this feeling at international cricket, like the players are ready and they're there. And it's like, well, no, because we pick players on promise all the time at international level, right? We pick players
even with that,
who are not sure of themselves.
You need to tread lightly with, even saying, how do I make this player better? Because you might think the player can get better, but you need to buy that in from the player himself or herself. Because if the player doesn't buy into what you're saying about getting better, then you've almost kind of broken a bridge at the elite level, right? You need to buy them into the fact that they can be better about in their own game, so to speak, right? Now, you can't go to a Virat Kohli or a Rohit Sharma and say, you can be better, right? Because, how do you do that?
By the way, I'm pretty sure there's a conversation where Greg Chappell actually said that to Sachin Tendulkar.
Never mind. But you know what I mean? Like, even if you believe they can be better, there's a nuanced way in putting that across. And you buy them in. Like, you got to earn their trust, right?
Yeah.
For them to say, I think this, what do you think about this? Do you think that this aspect can be slightly better, or are you happy with it? Because at that level, at the elite level, it's confidence, right? It's confidence in your own game. Even Virat Kohli, when he was batting well and scoring runs and having that like, I don't know if you call it a purple patch, it was like that streak of form that he went through where it just runs by the buckets and then suddenly that just left him, right? The same player, right? The only thing that was missing when he was scoring runs was where he was not scoring runs. Because even when he was scoring runs, he was still getting caught in the second slip and first slip. Right? The weakness outside the off stump existed.
Yes.
But he was scoring runs. Right? The only difference was the confidence was not there when he was not scoring runs. So at that level, confidence is such a huge factor. Right? It's how good you feel about your own game. It's how it's you second guessing and having those doubts, and those doubts become real when you get out there 4 or 5 times and then you suddenly feel like, oh, I genuinely have a weakness. And then he went and changed his hands, and then his hands, which was coming from third slip, came to first slip, then went to the wicketkeeper. And then he went away after, retiring from Test cricket and playing only one format right now. And then suddenly he's rediscovered himself. The bat's coming back from where it was coming from when he was scoring runs 5 years ago, or 4 years ago, or 3 years ago. Right? And that coaches need to be very careful about. Right? It's about earning the trust of elite level players and making and communicating in a way where if they feel that they need to improve on something, then let's work on it. Gary Kirsten, I can tell you, did that exceptionally well.
So, before I started becoming an analyst with teams, I contacted my uncle. So my uncle used to run the education department in Victoria, right? A very respected person. And I sort of said to him, like, I'm going to be trying to come up with quite full-on concepts for people sometimes who won't have even finished high school, right? Like, what do I do? And he said, if you're trying to educate someone and they don't want to be educated, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
Right? He said, see, the first thing is you need to work out what they want, right? And what they need. And then from that, you can slip, if you get their confidence and their trust and you become part of it. And it's funny, when I went to St. Lucia, that was such a shit show of a franchise that it all fell apart. And, relationships that I had there were struggling because of how bad the team was going and because of the ownership group and everything else. But over at Scotland, I found that a lot easier to be, to get in and to to have these conversations. And, you know, you still have issues and everything because it's a competitive environment and everyone, you know, and they're all like, oh, he's only here for 5 minutes and everything else. So, yeah, it really is hard to get people to do things just because of your force of will or your personality. Yeah. Now, you and I are not Gambier and McCallum type people, right? Like, we are different kinds of people. But essentially, at the end of the day, you really want people to buy in anyway, right? You do want them to understand, because if they don't buy in, it's just you kind of dictating to them. And as you said before, it may not be the right thing anyway. So there is an element of that. Very quickly, I'm going to say three IPL franchises to you, Robbie. There happen to be three IPL franchises.
I think that this deserves a separate show.
Okay, so we're not doing it at all. Good, because I did have notes here. And I did realize that I only picked IPL franchises that you've played for. But we will do that. I tell you what.
I hope
I'm going to do a special episode. I'm going to do a special episode with you on the IPL.
Yeah.
We're going to put up some graphics and so I can show you some things as well.
Yeah.
So let's just get to the super chats, because I think there are a kabillion of them.
Yeah.
Thank you to everyone who's come through. Siddharth says, J-Rod with Simon Jordan is so hilarious. Low-key fun. Do you know who Simon Jordan is? Like, is Simon Jordan someone who's entered your worldview?
Not yet.
So Simon Jordan's the main presenter on TalkSport, and we've had a couple of episodes together where they've put me in. And it's fair to say, I'll send you the link, Robbie, and see how Simon Jordan handled me on the first one. I don't think he was quite ready for what I said, and he hasn't handled it very well. But I'll be back on again.
Was he scandalized?
I think he couldn't get over the fact. I spent 5 minutes saying the English team was dumb. And I think Simon Jordan is a big alpha male guy. He's a big about, and he was all on the Ben Stokes, Brendan McCullum thing. And I'm like, yeah, you can be tough and you can be confident, but at the end of the day, if you're dumb, it doesn't mean as much. And it's fair to say that I might have said that a little bit too strongly for poor Simon. and of course, the next test match they lost again. Samit says, 2002-03, Nats lost the Ashes in 11 days with an inferior team versus a great Australian team. Today's England had more tools, fewer excuses. How does Stokes, Baz, and Key realistically recover? I think that's the issue that we're talking about here.
If they lose one more test match, I think they'll go and restructure.
What do you mean?
I think they'll go back to the drawing board and they'll have to. I think
you mean for the last two games?
Not for the last two games. If they lose one more test match, then...
I think, honestly, mate, I think it might already be done. I think, I think the structure as it is at the moment, I don't think they will continue with. Because they had a lot of success early on, and then they were an interesting team who could beat good teams for a while, and now it's fallen apart. There's too much talent in this team for them. That's what Samit's basically saying. There's too much talent in this team for them to be as bad as they have been.
100%.
Right. And that... And at that stage, you unfortunately have to look at leadership, right?
Yeah. I really hope that someone like Ollie Pope, who's in terrible form at the moment, doesn't catch the bad end of the stick here, because some of these guys, because he's a high quality player. I think he's important for England's future, given Joe Root is where he is in his career. And Zach is batting the way he's batting. And will Zach continue to step up? Because he's been very patchy with his form anyway.
Do you know what's weird about them, right? Is those two guys are about to hit their peak batting ages.
Yeah, and they so are. Which is why I'm saying this.
Yeah, they'll probably get dropped. And then they'll go into first-class cricket and make a million runs. And everyone will be like, well, we can't go back to those guys. And it's like, the issue here is that they should have been dropped in their mid-20s, right? And you know what it's like to go back, start again. Because
you're still like, you're getting everything together, right? It's all assimilating. Because you've experienced stuff and then you know you need to up your game in certain areas and you're assimilating all of those things and it takes time. You'll go through patchy form and you get through that, and then that's when everything matures and like sits in, right?
100%.
And the worst thing they could do right now for themselves as England cricket is to drop Ollie Pope.
But they have to drop Ollie Pope.
Maybe for a series.
Yeah. I don't mean forever. I think they have to say to him, you had a great run, but you're not making runs against good attacks. A lot of people will say his average isn't that bad. I'm like, his average isn't that bad, partly because of Zimbabwe and Ireland. if you look at him against in the World Test Championship, his average is really, really poor when he's playing the top eight sides, right? So he has to, you have to send him back to first class cricket, but let him know that this is not the end, right? Yeah. You're waiting for him to prove that he can come back. The biggest issue is he's always made runs in first class cricket, so he probably will. But anyway, Samit says, saw some great slips catching. Robbie, did you feel much at slip in Ranji Trophy? What changes needed to be India versus Australia, South Africa? Best Indian slip fielder, Dravid has numbers, Rahane versus Spin. But 100%. For me, Azhar, it was the closest to Mark Waugh.
Yeah, agreed. I'll tell you the best slip fielder I've seen. Outside of Rahul Dravid is Manish.
You mean in India?
Yes. In India, in domestic. Yeah. Oh, dude, he was so good at slips, especially when Karnataka we won the treble back to back. He was so good at the slips. We would do slip catches with a baseball bat, and we would do it for like an hour, and our slip catching got so good. I didn't stay in the slips for too long because I had like. For me,
wicketkeepers aren't very good in the slips.
We're not. Yeah, when you go behind the stumps, it's like if you're wearing the gloves and then you go behind the stumps without the gloves, it just feels weird, you know. And it feels like if you're standing in the slips, you might as well stand, you know, there. And so I try and avoid standing there because I wasn't like early on in my career I was good, but then later on it became hard because with wicketkeeping it just didn't feel right, and I preferred mid off, mid on. You know, I would do silly point shot. Like to the spinners, I prefer it because it felt like, okay, you can chew away at the batter a little bit. You can annoy them a little bit. You could sledge a little bit. That was fun. But not the fast bowlers.
Azharuddin was incredible, by the way. Andy says, as someone who cares about CSK, what did Robbie make of their auction? Does he see a contender in that squad? I don't see a contender in the next couple of years, but I actually love their auction. Not that we're going to get into too much here. And because they treated their auction like a draft, and they're setting themselves up for the next, maybe not the next 2 years, but the 4 years after that.
Thank you very much. Very well said.
Off air, Robbie said he hated their auction.
Now I laugh at your rumors.
Naveed says, CSK seemed focused on backups after settling their middle, their 11 mid-season last year. Despite their price tags, could both Veer and Kartik miss the starting 11?
So I don't think we'll miss it.
Yeah, well, they might miss it, right? But I don't think they focused on backups. Sure. I think they focused on long-term.
Yeah, they focused on long-term. And I think Veer will play. Because I think he was picked as a replacement for Jadeja, and Karthik, we don't know. We'll see if he'll play or not.
Brian Lara used pot plants to work on his placement. John Wright glued his glove to his bat. Sachin Tendulkar dug up practice pitches. Tatenda Taibu cut the top off his bat. Claire Taylor used a hockey grip. Steve Smith was from tennis. Dean Jones would call phantom runs. And Victor Trumper turned the Nets into a war zone to survive. The best batters in the world do whatever they have to make runs. We have told their stories in our new book, The Art of Batting. Sidhoff says, the auction that just went by is another example of why I hate the auction system. It does nothing positive for any stakeholders involved except to have 1 or 2 days of eyeballs before the season. Backward. So,
Thank you very much, Sid. I've been saying this for over half a decade now.
Me and Robbie, before we knew each other, agreed on this.
Yeah.
It's another situation where two young players have so much pressure on themselves now because of this auction setup. And they have to be fantastic players to live up to this. And it's great for them. They've changed their families' lives and everything. So financially, it's great. But they're getting paid like way more than really, really good seasoned IPL players are getting.
Remember what happened to Pawan Negi after he got 8.55 crores, the auctions?
Tyrone Henderson, Tamal Mills. Tamal Mills has been really honest. He's like, I shouldn't have been paid that much. And I never got back to the IPL because everyone was like, I was a bust. And he's like, I wasn't that level of player to begin with. I was overpaid, right? Yeah. It's tough. It's really tough paying players like that. It's putting pressure on them.
At some point, Indian cricket has to start caring about young cricketers and the impact this will have. There has to move to a draft system at some point. At some point. This is not... I love the fact what this does for the cricketers in the short term.
Yeah.
But it's not great in the long term.
It does actually ruin
careers. For crying out loud, we're still selling people like cattle on live television.
Yeah, but they're only cricketers, so no one cares. Naveen says, Rob Barron mentioned that England used to have a world-class analyst team, and now they don't have any analysts. Why did England stop trusting or using data? By the way, Rob Barron loves Robbie. Yeah, yeah. Rob Barron loves Robbie. And one day I will get the odd together. I won't even be on the podcast. I'll just see what happens of the two Robs together. Rob Barron's crazy. You're going to love Rob Barron. Yeah, they did. I mean, their analyst was, the last analyst that worked with them was Freddie Wilde. And obviously he went to RCB and he was still working for England. And then they basically, as far as I'm aware now, he's RCB's main analyst. I think he might do some other franchises as well. And Nathan Lehman was their analyst for a long time. They used to use analysts more than any other team. They got to world number one using analysts. They had the best, not just the best analysts in the team, but they have the best overall analyst setup when you look at the background and all that number crunching that they do. Far better than India, far better than Australia, and the other teams are miles behind those two. It was quite clear that McCallum didn't want to work with analysts anymore. They wanted a vibes-based team. Do you know what I would have said if I was their analyst for any of these test matches, Robbie?
What?
Ball it fucking off! Stop, you fucking idiot!
Yeah, well done.
Do you know? Obviously, I'm biased towards analysts, right? But there's a
they've overextended.
Right. I get it. I'm an analyst, and so obviously, I'm going to think more about analysts than other people. But there is a reason why you want analysts in teams, and it is because they are the cold cup of coffee. Yeah. They are the ones. Yeah. I remember chatting to Nathan Lee. Nathan Lehman's really interesting, actually. And I remember chatting to him once, and I won't throw him completely under the bus here, but I remember him basically saying, it was talking about wicketkeepers dropping catches. And I was saying, oh, you know, blah, blah, blah about wicketkeepers. And he goes, yeah, that's what the gloves are for, Jared. Right? Now, obviously, he's not going to say that to an international wicketkeeper, right? But that's kind of what you want from an analyst. You want the analyst to be like, guys, are we doing this right? Or are we just doing it because we do it? Or we keep doing this. We keep saying this is our plan, but it's not working. That is what you want from an analyst. Yeah. You don't want some scared teenager from IIT who won't speak up, right? You want someone who is world-weary, who's willing to say things, right? Nathan Lehman was a teacher beforehand, right? Freddie Wilde was a journalist. I was a journalist, you know, and, you know, Prasanna is someone who's willing to speak up of quite clearly. Right? That's what you want. Not because analysts are geniuses, but because analysts are the people who speak against the tide. Right. Analysts are the people who are like, we get it. I get why you want to do this, but is this the right thing to do? Right. Yeah. Like, I remember being in a meeting once where, like, I was in a selection meeting and it was quite clear that this selection meeting was completely split. Right. And both of the sides wanted me to go to their side. And I said, when it comes down to it, there is no correct answer here, guys. We just have to make a decision. There is no correct answer. I can look at, and they were like, oh, you're sitting on the fence. I said, no, it's not my job to sit on the fence. When I have the data that can give you an answer, or when I have the information that can give you an answer, I'll give it to you. But you also have to accept sometimes that there is no right answer here. And you guys on one side want this, and on the other side want that. That's what you need. Cold cup of coffee, right? What, I've never seen a cricket team that needed analysts more than this England team in the Ashes in the last couple of weeks.
No shit, brother. No shit.
Vaishak said, England obsessed with 140 kilometers pace, but winning in Australia needs skills, seam control, and relentlessness. Stain, Philander, Bumrah, Shami, Ishant, Siraj is better than pace. I mean, I'm going to be, Vaishak, you're right, but I'm going to say that if England had access to Stain, Philander, Bumrah, Shami, Ishant, and Siraj, they would have picked them, right? There is an element of what they had was a lot of pace. They didn't have a lot of skillful bowlers who were bowling at 85 to 86 miles an hour. Having said that, Matthew Potts has not played a test match yet, and he's not on the level of these guys you've mentioned here, but Matthew Potts is the England version of Scott Boland, right? Not quite the same level of bowler, but that kind of bowler, and they didn't give him a single test match because they were too obsessed with pace. So I don't disagree with that overall. We've got a couple here that where there's no question. Raksha, if you can just go through, there's a couple from Bart and Varun and everything else. I can come back to them at the end. That guy with M says, Jared's thoughts on vice captaincy have aged well. So there's a bunch of things that cricket teams do That doesn't make any sense to me. One is this obsession with telling everyone who vice captains are and making a big deal of it when a player is a fringe player in the side. The other one is selecting a team a week before a test match and letting everyone on the opposition know who they have to prepare for. In American sports, where betting is so big, teams still, even it would make more sense in those sports at the moment, because betting is such a major part, to release the team early so that the betting world has the same information as everyone else, right? Mm. And yet every NBA game will put LeBron James down as questionable. The Lakers are always like, he's questionable, right? He's like, oh, we might be resting him from this next game. He can't be questionable every game, Robbie, but he's always listed as questionable because they don't want the opposition to know whether they're going to rest LeBron James or not, because they know that the team will change completely. And in cricket, the England are announcing it like 3 days beforehand, right? So that and vice captaincy completely do my head in. Anyway, rant over. Amart says, what has Jacob Duffy changed to bowl so well when his first class average is 32? I didn't realize it was that high. Jacob Duffy, I just think he's a tall, smart, skillful bowler. And I wonder if he's matured a little bit as he's got older and he's understood exactly what a tall bowler needs to do. You know, you watch someone like Cameron Green. Cameron Green has so many skills, but hasn't quite worked out that tall bowlers just need to find a length. Right. Mm. And they need to find the length that works for them. Yeah. Specifically what Robbie just said, find their length and just hit it. And that allows you, once you can find that as an international bowler, especially what's Duffy? 6'5", 6'6", maybe? He's quite tall.
Yeah.
Once you do that, that actually allows you to upskill the rest of your game.
Well, he hasn't played in India yet. So has he? Has he played in India yet?
No. But I mean, obviously we'll save this for the IPL auction. What I like about Duffy is that he's the backup for Hazelwood in that squad, right? Mm. Because he is the closest kind of Hazelwood-like bowler. He might not be successful in India, but he's a much better bowler than I remember when he was young. Like, he was fine. He's a much better bowler than when he was young at the moment.
How old is he?
I want to say, is he late 20s? Is he? He might even be 30, right? 31. He's had a phenomenal year. Have you looked at his numbers in cricket? He really has had a phenomenal year.
He's averaging 12 or something, isn't he?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Right across cricket. He's played four test matches at the moment and he's got a bowling average of 16. So it's another sort of Scott Boland situation, right? I would also assume that maybe the wobble ball's played a part in this, that he's maybe protected the white wobble ball 100%. Of recent times. That guy with M says, is India the most likely side in history to defend the T20 World Cup? No, the most likely side in history to defend it was the West Indies.
Did they defend it? Didn't.
No, they didn't. But they were the most likely, weren't they? They won in 2012 or 2016. Mm. They should have won it. And then the other team that should have won two in a row is England in 21-22. But in 21, remember they had like five of their starting 11 were injured. And so they ended up losing in the semifinals, I want to say, to New Zealand. I think Daryl Mitchell might have had a big game against them. But they were the best team in that tournament.
The one that happened in Dubai, right?
Yeah, them or Pakistan should have won that tournament. They were the two best teams. And Australia ended up stealing that one. And then England won the next one. So I would say both of those teams are up there with India of teams that should have won it. But yeah, no one's defended so far. It's hard, right? Winning consistent T20 leagues or tournaments is so hard. Like back to back.
Yeah, it's also because the game's so on the day, right? It's not like you can flip a game on its head in a matter of 8 balls, 10 balls, right?
Yeah.
So it's also who plays cricket better on that particular day.
It has, you in T20 cricket, you have the lowest percentage of wins for a successful team. So in Test cricket, it's really high. In ODI cricket, it's quite high. And in T20, it drops a little bit. So if you can win 60 to 65% of your games in T20, you're really, really top side, right?
Yeah.
Whereas if you win that many in one day cricket, you're a good side, but you're not like thought of as a great side.
Yeah.
That's the variant. It was Freddie Wilde who told me that. Freddie Wilde used to be the England's analyst when they actually played smarter cricket.
What is this about today? You're like promoting a lot of analysts and journalists.
Just Freddie. Soham says, KK wrote a great article on Crick Info that noted Sky had technical problems creeping into his game. I don't remember the specifics, but it's a great read. Shout out to KK, the great man. Someone did send me this. I think I did read this and I now can't remember anything of it. Did you come across that article?
Not yet. I'll check it out.
I'll send you the link. I'm pretty sure I started to read it.
KK is a very astute observer of the game.
Have you ever met him? Do you know him?
Yeah.
Lovely guy. Yeah. Great, yeah. great drinking partner. Also, yeah. Very good at, he loves late night photography. He loves nighttime photography. There you go. Fun fact. People didn't know that about KK and now they know it. Bart says, Stokes remained in New Zealand, potentially competing with, if Stokes remained in New Zealand, potentially competing with Kane to be anointed the next generational great. Baz plus Roscoe 2.0. Yeah, it would be interesting to see where New Zealand would have been with Stokes in that side, right?
Yeah, ifs and buts.
No, I'm just saying.
Yeah, it would have been nice for sure.
Yeah.
Like, but I can only perceive him as an English player.
He's not an English player though, is he? Like, yeah. I mean, style of cricket.
Oh,
I suppose there's a bit of flint off in both of them in him as well. So I suppose
yeah,
a little
for sure,
bit.
Bro. Yeah,
he's probably not a New Zealand cricketer.
He's not a New Zealand cricketer.
Yeah, that's fair.
The only one who's been like who's had that kind of level of flamboyance in New Zealand that I can remember of is Baz.
Cairns. I wonder if Stokes grew up watching Cairns. I wonder if there's a Cairns influence. Yeah, Cairns was quite flamboyant, wasn't he?
Nathan Astor, quiet, but his batting was flamboyant.
Yeah. Kunov says, random question. Is masala Vegemite sandwich a good idea? Yeah. Have you ever eaten Vegemite?
I've tried it. I've just once for the sake of tasting it. I don't know how you guys eat that shit.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. We just ate it we ate it when we were kids.
I tried it once with butter. I remember I tried it once with butter. It was more palatable with something else in it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, you want Vegemite. The peak of Vegemite is really butter that is melted onto the toast. Right, you don't want it with butter that hasn't melted because then it becomes a weird swirly thing, and then you also want a cold piece of cheese. Right, is probably the best one, or some sort of cheddar anyway. But I think a cold piece of cheese almost works best, and then the three together work quite well. Yeah, but
cheddar might go well actually.
I don't know about masala and Vegemite together. I think that might be beyond me. Siddharth says J-Rod getting rage baited by Bazball's success mission.
Yeah.
One of the issues I have with all this, though, is that I actually really like... Well, they should have bolted off stuff. But I really do think that they have helped change the game. They've opened up the way that we think about Test cricket, and they did heaps of things right. The frustrating thing, and we did a whole episode on this recently, the frustrating thing is that they then believed that they were God's gift to everything and that everything that they did was right. And I think it's quite clear that has not been...
It's the English. They always think they're entitled.
Walking Alive says Stokes gets away with any criticism swiftly by calling his team weak, doing bare minimum blocking for 2 hours when the ball is 60 overs old. All talks of great leader of throwing the team under the bus. No, I think the one thing I would disagree with here, Walking, is I would be disappointed if Stokes hadn't come out and said that they have played poor cricket, right? I think Stokes has been frustrated with the bowling attack. Now, he was part of the reason they have this bowling attack, so he's going to take some of that blame. But I do think he has been frustrated with the fact that they can't keep any pressure back on Australia as well. And I think he's also been frustrated with the fact that the batters don't have multiple gears. But again, he was the one that pushed this whole Bazball star, right? So maybe he's just waking up out of the coma. Bart says, KP waited like Faf for his South Africa colours, still hit similar peak. Kevin Peterson. Context. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Bart's all about the alternative histories here. I think KP's a much better player than Faf in pure skill and everything else. And so I think he would, I don't compare the two of those players on skill level. I think Faf's an incredible professional and the way he thinks about cricket and everything I really respect. But if you're talking about batting skill, KP's an absolute genius from another planet.
He's super talented.
Varun says, of the three series I've watched recently, Australia versus India, England versus India, and Australia versus England, India versus India was easily the best. Think of moments like the Will Jacks, Ben Stokes partnership. The whole BGT felt like that. Yeah, I think that, it probably was the best of the three series, but it was also a wicket heavy series. And so it's always going to be a little bit more interesting and a little bit more tense, I think, because it meant that even though India lost that series, they were always maybe one or two good spells or good partnerships from coming back in.
Yeah.
And you have that with low scoring series, right? You almost always feel like the other team could come back in it. Whereas England versus India was a bit more batting heavy and a bit more extreme. And Australia versus England, well, the less said, the better. Bart says, thoughts on the what ifs below? Oh, yeah, we did some of your what ifs. KL and Pope came in each in each's county's country system.
Each other's country system.
I'm trying to get that out. Okay, so if KL played in England and Pope played in India, would they be different?
I think KL would be different. His numbers would be different. I think KL would have loved England, given how close he plays to his body. If you,
yeah.
And after a point in England, the wickets get really flat, right? And then, and it comes on so beautifully.
Yep.
Like, he would have scored. He would have been probably in the 40s or 50s even.
And Pope, even if he was never going to be a great player of spin, if he had been in that system, he would obviously be a lot better against it. Yeah. And that's one of his big weaknesses. I know it hasn't mattered in this series, but one of his big weaknesses is that. We did that one, mate.
Yeah, we did.
Lokesh says, love the show. Thanks for doing what you do. Lokesh, we love you. Thanks for doing what you've done. Tamil says, hello, guys. How do you see Talapé in this IPL, an impact sub or in the 11?
In the 11. I think if he's playing, he'll want to do the whole thing. Like, I don't think he'll want to just bat and go. If there's a choice between batting and wicket-keeping as an impact player, like if they say you have to play only as an impact player, you'd be like, okay, let me keep.
Andy says,
I reckon you'd say that.
Yeah, no, I think it's fair. Isn't there a gulf between this Indian white ball team and Morgan's England? Feels like the batting has a higher ceiling, better bowlers, and Pandya is better than Stokes. Yes, but you've got to remember that a lot of the work that the England team did, you're talking about that retrospectively, but at the time, the England white ball team was so good because it was so far ahead of everyone else, right? That's right. But I think you're right. I think the big issue that England always had was that Plunkett and Rashid had to do so much heavy lifting in that team. However, I think when Pete Joffre came in, that's when they were at their absolute best, that England team as well. I think that did change that team quite a bit because Joffre was so good. And then you had the middle overs, you had a little bit up top, and then you had the stuff at the end. Runook says, name a cricketer who proved analysts wrong with performance and another who used analysts to revive his career. Also explain how analysts scout talent with limited data.
Not a question.
All cricketers prove analysts wrong because all an analyst is really doing is looking at a bunch of data. And if a player upskills themselves, so Mustafiz Rahman, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you look at what he went for a lot in the auction, and my first thought was, what the hell? I've been watching him play in the IL T20 last week, and I'm like, oh, I get it. He looks really good at the moment. He looks not quite like peak Mustafizah, but back towards peak Mustafizah. So if you would have asked me 6 months ago whether he was worth 7 crores or 9 crores or whatever they paid him, I would have laughed in your face, right? But players are always upskilling themselves, right? So all an analyst is looking at is what has happened. Another analyst who used another player who used analysts to revive their career. Karuna Ratner is a famous example of that. Sean Massoud is a famous example of that. Stuart Broad is a famous example of that. So there's quite a few of guys who've changed their career. As far as with how analysts use limited data, you're looking for patterns. You're looking for patterns in any stage. So once you have enough things there, you can start to work out what the pattern is. So I've been watching Shadab Khan bowl recently because he took wickets in Australia. And my first thought was, well, maybe it's just because Australians don't play leg spin very well, right? And then I went back and I had a look. And the first thing I could see is that his groin is fixed and his action, he's getting through his action again. So that's the first pattern I'm looking for. It doesn't matter to me if his figures don't match that. I can see that he's bowling butter. It turns out his figures do match that. Andy's... No.
We've done this.
Siddharth says, simple logic. If Sanju opens over Gill, Kishan as opener backup makes sense. Also leaves Rinku as finisher backup. Seems fair?
Yeah.
You happy with that one? Yeah. Thank you, Siddharth. Prudvi says, in a 5-match test series, which would you choose? Bumrah for 3 tests or Stark for 5 tests?
You could choose Bumrah. How about 2 tests? I'd choose, if I'm going just by form, Stark, for sure. If I'm choosing on skill, Bumrah.
If it's 3 years ago, you might actually pick Bumrah. If it's right now...
Not even 3 years ago. Don't have to go that far back. Go 18 months ago.
No, but before Stark, like Stark's reached a level he's never been at before, right?
Yeah.
So I think if you're looking a couple of years ago, you might think, well, if we have Bumrah, we're more likely to win the 3 tests. So let's go with that. Whereas at the moment, even if you say Stark hasn't reached Bumrah-like levels, he is so good at the moment that I don't think you could overlook him, right? I'm not sure if Varun Gandhi got his message up. So let me just put him on the screen as well, I say, as I click away from him. So thank you. Thank you to everyone for all your comments and your chats and everything else. We'll be back again. Robbie will be in South Africa.
Yeah, I'm leaving Christmas morning.
You enjoyed the SA20. I remember. Oh, wait. Yeah, Warren says. Oh, yeah, we've done. We did do Warren's question. I still remember the first time I heard you commentate in the SA20 and you were on a grass embankment with Mark Nicholas, just having a chat. a very, very different kind of commentary. So I'm sure we'll hear that as well. But please like, subscribe. If you listen on the audio podcast, leave us a review there as well. But do all those things. And me and Robbie will be back very soon for more of Kim Apple.
And we will need more ranting. We need more ranting.
I didn't like rant. It. There was no ranting.
That was amazing. I loved it. We need more of that.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bahram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.